Here's a phrase I want you to contemplate. American history is the history of money. It comes from a guest on this week's show, but it's kind of a radical thought. Are we as a country so intertwined with capitalism that it holds true for everything? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're digging into a bunch of different corners of America and our relationship with money, what we spend it on, what our safety net ought to be. We'll go outside the U.S., too, to see how China is wrestling with a disappearing resource, and underground to see what can be built if we stretch our own limits a little bit. Come talk to us whenever you want, on our website, marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're kicking off the show this week, as we generally do, with our particular way of looking at the news, when we go long and short on various things, betting on them or against them. And this week, we have Marketplace's Adrian Hill and Zoe Schlanger from Newsweek. Welcome to you both.
Thanks. Hey. Great to be here.
Zoe, since you're the guest, I'm going to let you go long first. What are you long?
I am long today on CRISPR. It's a gene editing technology that's doing things we've been completely unable to do in the history of science. And it's technology that's moving so quickly that we've gone in the past 4 years from editing yeast genes to like editing human embryos as of last year.
Wow.
Should we be editing human embryos, Zoe?
Yeah. Well,
see, this is why it's such a great story. It's not going anywhere. You can bet on this story because it's got all of the ethical implications. Someone just got the first go-ahead in the UK to edit human embryos. So the ethical questions are definitely still up in the air, and the regulations are nowhere near moving as fast as the science. I just spent about 4 hours the other day at a DIY hacking lab in Brooklyn where they are learning how to do this on yeast cells.
Wow.
It's not hard.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The DIY hackers, they're nothing to be really concerned with. But as the technology moves faster and faster, we really don't know it's coming. Even they don't.
Adrian, then I'm going to shift and go for your long, which is less science fiction-y, but also in the realm of what?
Of life and death. I will say I'm long on planning for our death, Lizzie. I mean, I am so shocked that Prince didn't have a will. He was such a forward thinker in so many ways. And the idea that he's leaving his estate, an estate he controlled so thoroughly.
So tightly.
Yeah. The idea that he just sort of left that up in the air is wild. So, I mean, a will could still emerge here, but hopefully we're all going to start thinking a little bit harder about planning for the inevitable, our death.
And it's really such a shame that his legacy now is going to be tied up in whatever legal scenario happens next.
It's too bad that, you know, this has become the territory of lawyers instead of, you know, music lovers.
Zoe, I want your short now because I have a sense that it is controversial in this studio.
My short is Zika virus, and it's maybe not for why you think it might be. I'm not going to tell you anything comforting about the Zika virus, but only that I think with climate change and shifting patterns of populations and how much we travel, hotter temperatures is going to mean that mosquitoes are going to be dangerous from now on, not just a nuisance. So next summer, Zika is not going to be the mosquito-borne illness du jour. It's going to be something else.
But so you're short Zika as a phenomenon. Oh, yeah, go ahead, pregnant lady.
No, I mean, as a currently pregnant lady, I have to say, like, how can I possibly short Zika? Like, I'm freaked. I'm freaked about traveling to, like, the southern states later this summer. Yeah. Should I feel reassurance here from you?
So as far as traveling to the southern states, the one thing I can assure you on is that we have pretty incredible mosquito control in this country. It's the reason we eradicated malaria in like 1920s when people were, before that, dying every year by the thousands in this country. We do aerial spraying, which has potential health implications, but it does take care of the job. For example, dengue was something that we have little outbreaks of once in a while. And that's what the CDC and the NIH are saying now, that if Zika shows up in this country, which I suppose it will, it'll be cases maybe by the dozens in local areas. There won't be a widespread outbreak.
So this is sort of a complicated short play, I guess, if we're thinking about it in stock market terms. You are short this particular manifestation, but maybe long the phenomenon of mosquito-borne illness.
Definitely. We have a lot coming to us.
All right, Adrian, bring your entertainment correspondent hat to this one and explain your short to us.
I'm short standard television ads. You might have seen the news this week that SNL is going to sort of dial back the number of traditional ad breaks it takes and instead put more branded advertising in the show. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that. Fewer of these ads that maybe we grew up with watching television. But it's really interesting. I have a 3.5-year-old. And when we've been watching the NBA playoffs, he's like, what is that? Like, he doesn't ever see advertisements except during basketball because we watch Netflix and Amazon and Hulu without ads. And so he doesn't see them. And I just think we're moving in this direction where people just won't tolerate them except maybe during live events.
But does that mean that you have more and more kind of sponsored content? I'm thinking of Kimmy Schmidt has a couple of sort of fakes to the camera this season where they recognize that they are doing product placement. The American public is pretty savvy now. So how does a company then try to make money via some kind of advertising, which they're still going to do?
Right. I mean, I think with SNL example, they're sort of taking, say, maybe a page out of the Colbert Report's book where it was sort of worked into the programming as a part of the joke. Like, look, you know, I think SNL, like, go to JCPenney for mom jeans. Ha, 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 ha. But then JCPenney's in our brains and, like, our moms are in our brains.
So in other words, ads will still work, but it depends on how we're consuming the TV at this point.
Yeah, and I think people just don't want to consume with all those breaks anymore. Like, we've been trained out of those breaks. Although, when are we going to go to the bathroom, you guys?
Adrian Hill, Zoe Schlanger, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Last week, we asked you to weigh in on paid family leave, which is being adopted in several states. We had a pretty robust discussion among our listeners on Facebook. Liz Lopez, who lives in Mountain View, California, thinks everyone should have it.
I think paid family leave is something that should be granted to everyone in the United States, and it's a shame that we're the only first world country that doesn't really have it.
Looking for a job in tech? She even did this.
Now that I'm in a position where I can be a little choosy about my employer choice, I always bring that up in the context of all the other benefits that the employer offers, and I've got a couple of mixed responses.
What kind of mixed responses?
Some places have said that, you know, they do offer family leave. I've had places where they said, no, we don't offer that right now. We're a startup. We're very lean. And I've actually had one CEO say to me, you know what? No one's ever actually asked me that question before. And I actually responded to him that, well, I'm kind of not surprised because I'm the only woman, it seems, to be working at this company. So we laughed about it. And he said that, you know, he is definitely going to take that into consideration. And so that was, you know, a satisfactory answer. And I was willing to sort of take the risk possibly joining that company because I would get paid pretty well. And also the founder was willing to think about it.
Matt Nicholson in Seattle doesn't have kids of his own and framed the question as one of patriotism.
In order to say that you truly care for America, that you truly love America, you should care for and love all Americans. I'm a single person. I don't have kids, but I do have parents. I have friends in their 30s that are having children. And, you know, this is the sort of problem that affects all of us.
You wrote something in your Facebook post to us that your parents were thinking of themselves and lower taxes, and they didn't see how that could come back on your generation. So I guess you're saying you're willing to pay more to sort of have a national system.
Yes. Even in cases where I wouldn't benefit, according to my personal belief on American patriotism, I want to do this for other people.
Other people think leave decisions should be left to employees and companies. Sean Moran's wife was fired from her job in Levittown, Pennsylvania, after giving birth to their second daughter. But he's not on board with a federal paid leave program.
I don't think it should be government mandated, especially at the federal level. I'm not sold on the state level either. And what it comes down to is, on a personal level, would I have liked it? Of course I would have liked it. But then you take a step back and realize, well, that money has to come from somewhere. So where's it going to come from?
You own your own business, right?
Yes.
And in your office, what kind of policies do you guys have?
We don't actually have a formal policy regarding that, and it's not a situation that's come up, but the people that I have working for me are people that I would do everything in my power to retain. So I would try to work out as best as I could something to keep them happy while still able to cover our expenses.
Jessica French in Chicago works in HR, so she's seen this from a couple of angles. She quit her job to have two kids because she didn't have access to family leave.
The cost of childcare in Chicago is not very cheap, and it actually ended up financially for us more feasible for me to quit my job. And I had two children close together so that I could actually go back to work.
I wonder if you've spent more time thinking about this than most people, being someone who works in human resources. I'd imagine you have heard a lot of other people's stories about having to figure this out.
Absolutely. And I've had employees try to negotiate, actually, family time off. It's something that's important to everybody. Also, the job security thing as well. You know, it's not just about being paid, but it's knowing that you have a job to be able to go back to if you do take some time off.
What would you like to see if you could design a system, either in your city, state, the country?
This is difficult for me to answer because I see from the human resources perspective, I can see how federally, when you implement something federally, an entire industry pops up to be able to fight it, you know, to say, okay, well, this is how you don't have to comply, or this is the loophole that we found that you can jump through. But it's also, if you leave it up to employers, you can end up having, you know, an employer that's actually discriminating more, for example, or they're hiring based on, you know, I may have to provide you with this paid leave, and now I see you as a liability, and I don't want to hire you. And I could see where that could actually backfire. Maybe at a state level, but it would definitely have to come with resources, especially for those small employers. Because a lot of times, just like a minimum wage, when you legislate something that has to happen, you know, they may end up only doing the minimum instead of actually doing what they can to take good care of their employees.
Thanks to everyone who wrote or called us. At the top of the show, Adrian Hill mentioned Prince died without a will. So next week, we want to know, do you have a will? Why or why not? What questions do you have about them? Write to us at marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace, because behind every number in the business world is often a great story. On our website, marketplace.org, our By the Numbers blog finds the most interesting numbers in the news, and here are Marketplace's Eliza Mills and Tony Wagner with this week's news by the numbers. Our first number,
25%.
That's the portion of people who didn't know what artisan meant, according to a recent survey.
Others said it indicated something unique, high quality, or handmade.
Marketers love the word and use it liberally, slapping it on more and more food items.
Right. When McDonald's has an artisan chicken sandwich, what does artisan even mean anymore?
3 million.
That's how many people subscribe to Tidal as of late March.
But the service got another big boost last weekend from Beyoncé's Lemonade, which is streaming exclusively on Tidal.
Kanye West's The Life of Pablo was another exclusive, and it spurred a lot of new subscribers and a lot of piracy.
Once the digital dust clears and everyone's free trials expire, it's not clear how many people will stick around.
$15 million.
That's the most recent round of funding secured by Masterclass.
The startup lets you take online courses from celebrities like Usher, Serena Williams, and Annie Leibovitz.
It's a neat idea, but critics warn talent doesn't always make you an effective teacher.
That's okay. Usher has already taught me so much.
Now we're going to talk about that whole America and the history of money thing I mentioned at the top of the show. Plus, another thing I say a lot, which is where the economy meets real life. That's how we think about what we do here, mixing together larger economic and philosophical questions with our everyday realities. And it's a really nice fit with the latest book that Charles Whelan has written. It's called Naked Money, the third in his Naked series, after Naked Statistics and Naked Economics. Naked as in revealing. It's a really fun exploration of something we use every day. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
You've written Naked Statistics, Naked Economics, now Naked Money. it kind of feels to me like you're going backwards here, no? Why didn't you start with money?
We have finished the Naked series. One could start with money. I mean, it's really the basis of everything else that happens in the economy. So your point is a good one. But traditional economics tends to kind of gloss over money. It's all about transactions and people specializing and trading in ways that make them better off. And typically, we kind of overlook the medium by which those transactions happen. And as we learned in 2008 and on many other occasions, that's a dangerous thing to overlook.
Yeah. Well, then let me pose this very simple, easy-to-answer question to you. What's money?
Oh, what gave you the impression that's a simple, easy-to-answer question? Money can be lots of things. It is essentially a promise. It's something that denotes value. If you come over and rake my leaves and I write on a piece of paper, you know, Lizzie, I owe you 20 minutes of work at some other time— that could well be money. If people trust me and you use it to pay for something else, that becomes a medium of exchange. It's not a conventional one, but over the years, we've used commodities, so rice and gold and oil and other things like that, because they have obvious value, work for things as something that can facilitate a transaction. More recently, every industrialized economy has gone to fiat currency, which is pieces of paper. And everyone assumes that has no value, but in fact, as long as the rest of us believe it has value, and I'm willing to accept a $20 bill from you and someone else is willing to accept it from me, then that works fine too.
You go through a lot of things in this book, as you've explained, not just fiat currency, but gold, the gold standard, the Federal Reserve, etc. But there was a line that stuck out to me, which is American history is also the history of money. What do you mean?
Well, if you trace the way that money has played different roles throughout history, you hit all the important inflection points in American history. So you go back to the colonial period, and one of the great tensions with Great Britain was that they wouldn't allow the colonies to make their own money. Therefore, there was always a shortage of currency, and that became one of the friction points. If you fast forward a little bit and George Washington is trying to raise an army, they create the Continental, which is America's first bout of inflation, because the Continental, as you know from the expression not worth a continental, wasn't backed by any commodity. If you fast forward to the next chapter, next big chapter, the Civil War, a lot of what happened between the North and the South was that the North was more effectively able to borrow and therefore didn't have to print its own currency. You had much greater hyperinflation in the South than in the North. And so on. So as you go through, and in between, we had the First and Second Bank of the United States. We had the Great Depression, where we clung tenaciously to the gold standard, and that was almost certainly a mistake. So all the major historical things that you learned about in history class usually have some important monetary underpinning to them.
And as you point out in a chapter on both 1929 and 2008, we don't seem very good at learning those lessons. Why?
I think we've gotten better. I think 2008 could have been much, much worse. When you talk to some of the people who were involved in the very depths of that crisis, they will tell you that we didn't make the same mistakes that we made in 1929. So in 29, we had our hands cuffed by the gold standard. We were not able to prop up the banks as we could in 2008. And as unpopular as that was, it was the bank failures in 1928, 29, into the early 30s that led to the catastrophic outcomes that became the Great Depression. But it is also true that money, as we've already discussed, is a strange concept. Banking is a strange concept. People don't seem to realize that banking has inherent frailties. You're taking people's money and promising it back to them, with some exceptions, whenever they want it. And then you're turning around and lending that for long-term projects, buildings and college tuition, saying, you know what, you don't have to pay that back for 10, 15, 20 years. Well, anytime everybody wants their money back and you can't quite get it to them, even if the loans are solvent in the long run, you're going to have a banking crisis. And then you layer on top of that.
You bring up It's a Wonderful Life several times.
It's a Wonderful Life, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is the best example of the inherent frailties of the banking system. When everybody wants to get their money out of the Bailey Building and Loan, the fact that the Bailey Building and Loan is still solvent doesn't matter. Everybody wants their money now. And you remember he stands up on the counter and gives that eloquent speech about how their money is in somebody else's property and in mortgages and so on. Nobody cares. They want their money back now.
A lot of this is also, of course, about central banks, not just the commercial banks that someone like you or I might use, you have two characters in here, inflation-fighting man, a.k.a. Paul Volcker, and deflation-fighting woman, Janet Yellen. Why create these fictional or semi-fictional superheroes?
Well, the other person that comes up all the time is Goldilocks, which has great applications to central banking. The key to central banking is to preserve the stability of the currency. So we've already discussed the fact that the dollar in your pocket has no intrinsic value. It's not like gold or cans of tuna or something like that. So it falls to the central bank, in our case, the Federal Reserve, to protect the purchasing power of that paper currency, to ensure that it's worth roughly the same amount next year as it is this year. Now, that's a tricky thing to do. If there are bank failures or other disruptions to the economy, you may actually have to feed more money into the economy or else you get falling prices. You get deflation, which has all kinds of adverse consequences. On the other hand, if you print too much money, as Zimbabwe has done and the Weimar Republic has done and the Continental Congress did, then you get inflation. You get too much money chasing the same amount of goods. So the story of central banking is Goldilocks, too little monetary growth and you get prices falling, as Europe has experienced of late. If you get too much money, you get inflation. And the central bank has to get it right. Now, Paul Volcker was inflation-fighting man. He was the one who had to break the back of inflation in the 70s. More recently, Janet Yellen is deflation-fighting woman because that's the greatest threat to us right now on the horizon.
You end this book with the idea of doing central banking better, which, okay, that's a simple phrase and a really complicated mission. How would you do that?
I think the takeaways from 2008 are there were certain lessons that I was taught in graduate school that were reinforced. There are some things that really matter. One, for example, is that the central bank needs to be politically insulated. Now, it's interesting because when I was in grad school, I was taught that you need to keep the politicians away from the central bank because they always want to print too much money and there's an inflationary bias when the politicians are thinking about monetary growth. But what happened in 2008 is you had kind of the opposite going on, particularly from the political right where there was fear that we were creating too much inflation or even hyperinflation. If you remember the presidential race of 2012 and Rick Perry taking on Ben Bernanke and so on. The same basic idea, though, the central bank has to be somewhat insulated from these political pressures to stick to its mission, because often in the short run, doing what's right has some political costs. So there are things like that that the lesson was reinforced. But there are also things that we don't quite know. So, for example, the Federal Reserve was extremely aggressive in 2008. As you know, QE1, QE2, QE3, they loaded up their balance sheet and monetary growth was extraordinary by historical standards. What we still don't know is how we unravel that. So what happens going forward? How does the central bank kind of shrink its balance sheet? How does it restore interest rates to something resembling what we've known over the past 30 years as in contrast to this very strange period of near zero rates for so long? So there are things that we learned were right. There are things that we're not sure about. And going forward, it's going to make a lot of difference to the U.S. economy if we get these things right.
Charles Whelan's new book is Naked Money. Thank you very much.
Oh, it was great to be with you.
More than 20% of the world's population lives in China, but China only has 7% of the world's fresh water. That means that in the north of China, 500 million people live in areas that are deemed water scarce. This has a big economic impact, and the cost of China's water issues is around 2% of its GDP. Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz has been reporting on these water issues and has this story from the north of the country, where there's been so much development that water is running out.
Every morning at 5, Yang Shufang wakes up and fetches water.
I bring a few buckets, enough for drinking or cooking.
Yang doesn't live in the remote countryside, and her water isn't from a village well. She lives on the 7th floor of a luxury condominium complex in Lintao, a city with nearly 200,000 people that's run out of water.
Right after Chinese New Year, water stopped coming out of the tap. Now we have to stand in line each morning with our buckets and wait for water to be delivered.
Lintao is in Gansu province in China's arid northwest, situated along a tributary of the Yellow River. The combination of a drought and a surge of urban development means the city's underground water supply has dwindled to dangerously low levels, leaving tens of thousands of people without access to our most precious resource. Experts fear Lintao could be a sign of things to come.
400 Chinese cities now face a water shortage. 110 cities face a severe water shortage. This is a very serious problem.
Liu Changming is a retired hydrologist for the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. He advises China's leaders on water policy. He says all of these water-scarce cities are in northern China, home to a half a billion people and a region that contributes nearly half of China's economic growth.
When I first arrived to Beijing 60 years ago, there were springs everywhere. Some bubbled up half a meter high. But now the population's increased sevenfold, and there are seven ring roads around the city. That abundant water is gone.
China's former Minister of Water Resources, Wang Shucheng, has predicted at current rates of water use, Beijing, home to more than 20 million people, will run out of water in 15 years. Thing is, Wang said this 11 years ago. And that's why China's constructing the world's largest water transfer project at the cost of more than $60 billion. In all, 2,700 miles of man-made waterways will draw water from China's southern rivers and send it north. The equivalent of building a cement river that takes water from New York City and delivers it all the way to Los Angeles. Two of the three segments of China's south to north water diversion project are completed. Beijing began receiving water a year ago from the project's middle segment, a man-made waterway that draws water from the Han River, an important tributary of the Yangtze flowing through central China. The city celebrated the arrival of hundreds of billions of gallons of water as crisis averted.
Northern China needs water, but southern China suddenly doesn't need it? How can you take something others also need just because you're the capital? This is not just.
Journalist Dai Qing is author of Yangtze Yangtze, an investigation into the damming of China's biggest river. She says the state of her country's water, its scarcity and its toxicity, is the greatest danger facing China today.
Every year, the groundwater in northern China drops by a meter. 1 meter per year. That's frightening. But diverting water from the south is not the answer. It will alter nature, and it absolutely should not be done. We are not smarter than nature, nor are we more powerful.
Hundreds of miles south of Beijing, along the Han River in Hubei province, farmers return from the fields after a day's work. Since the South to North Water Diversion Project began, the water level in the river has dropped, says farmers Li Kaiding and Wu Tianzhong.
It's dropped so much that big ships can no longer navigate the river. Nobody told us the water level was going to drop. The upper level of the government notifies the lower level, but we're farmers, and nobody tells us anything.
I asked them what they think of the project. Before they can answer, a farmer whose dander is up launches into a screaming fit.
What does it matter what we think? We have no say anyway. No matter how good the policies from Xi Jinping are, the local government always messes it up.
Back in Lintao, the northern Chinese city that has run out of water, local officials have found a familiar solution. With the city's groundwater tapped out, the city is building a water diversion project, a pipeline that will draw hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the surface of the Tao River to meet the needs of the city's 200,000 residents. I asked County Manager Lei Yongping what kind of impact that'll have on the already parched Tao River.
It won't have any impact whatsoever. This has been certified by experts. If the experts didn't determine this, we wouldn't be building this pipeline.
I ask Lei where these experts were when his city ran out of water. A propaganda official at Mr. Lei's side jumps in to save him. Bian Dongsheng blames Lingtao's water crisis on a sudden influx of new residents to the city. His answer raises even more questions. I ask Bian why the leaders of a city with barely any water allowed a sudden population spike.
Our country is designated a national poverty alleviation region, and the central government requires us to move these people to the city to lift them out of poverty and raise the urbanization rate. We can't allow these people to drag down the central government's goal of building a moderately prosperous society by 2020.
Bien's slogan-filled answer is fit for a propaganda poster. Moderately prosperous society is the official lingo for President Xi Jinping's goal to urbanize China. And the pressure from China's leadership on rural communities like this to urbanize, explains Bien, means Lin Cao has run out of groundwater.
Our economy must develop very, very fast. This is a central government policy. Only this way can we bring our people out of poverty. Our government is trying our best to restore water to Lingtao, but the momentum of economic development will not be stopped. No force can stop it.
Not even, insists Bien, the force of nature, as more and more humans compete for a dwindling supply of water. In northern China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
At the top of the show, I mentioned stretching our concept of what is possible, like this idea of an urban park underground, where plants grow with light that's been bounced off a series of reflectors via NASA-level technology. It's called the Low Line, and right now it's an experiment in an old market building, sort of a test version. I went to visit it with Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson. We wanted to meet the founders hoping to get more than $60 million to build a 60,000-square-foot version under New York City.
I'm Dan Barish. I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Low Line.
I'm James Ramsey. I'm co-founder and the creator of the Low Line.
This looks like the bottom of like a geodesic dome and Little Shop of Horrors.
So what we've done here is we've taken over an abandoned former market building and blackened out the space to make it feel like we're underground. And we've installed a version of our solar technology on the rooftop that collects and harvests natural sunlight all day and then directs it into this otherwise darkened space.
This is something that we've called the Low Line Lab, and it's a test facility. Basically what we do is we track the sun, we focus the sunlight down to 30 times the brightness of the sun, and it becomes this sort of super concentrated beam of sunlight that we then send through tubes. And until they sort of arrive at this center point, this nexus of the lab, where we then shoot them back out and spread that light back out to grow stuff.
James, you send it through the tubes with mirrors.
It's a combination of mirrors and lenses.
Okay.
So, we use mirrors to, aim the beam, change direction, et cetera. And then we use lenses to refocus the beam just in case it starts spreading out. So we can keep it a nice cylindrical, sort of like a laser beam of sunlight.
There's a strawberry.
There was one big, beautiful baby strawberry on that central leaf, and someone came in
definitely
and just
some missing.
Casually grabbed it like they were walking through, a bodega. I mean, these are strawberries that have grown from seed in the middle of this, indoor park that we built.
You have ferns, you have mother-in-law tongue, that's an air cleaning plant.
Yes, we have a lot of air cleaning plants, that's for sure.
There's 70 different species in here. A lot of these plants have been here since we built the installation itself in October. Some of them are newer than that. And some of them have grown so much that we've had to hack them down, almost in a sort of a tropical environment and other
You've
species.
You've got some spider webs.
We do.
That's good.
That is a good thing.
We have some friends.
Yeah, I mean, this is not just flora, but there's also some fauna here, right? You know, we actually had a couple of hitchhikers. We had a tree frog came along with one of the plants. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, so if you were to flash forward a few years, what would you like to see this be?
I mean, the vision for the Low Line is to be the world's first underground park right here in New York City. And we think this is, it's a really important idea in any city, but especially in New York, which is such a dense, crowded environment. I think a lot of people sometimes think that you need to choose between city or nature. And I think what we're trying to do is infuse a bit of nature into a site that otherwise would be used for nothing. Another side of this is thinking about the vast potential of the underground. So we have been building up and out for centuries now, and we haven't really thought about the great potential that lies below the sidewalks of the street. So here we have acres and acres of spaces below the city, and what we want to do is shift that paradigm a little bit and imagine that we can have these incredibly vibrant spaces that are designed for public use underground.
Which leads me to my next question. This is a business show. How much would that cost?
So we know this is going to cost us north of $60 million. And that's something that is both a big number and a small number when you look at the economic and social impact that we're looking to drive. So we've already, as I've mentioned, driven 50,000 visitors to this location. We're estimating many, many, many more people coming to visit the Lowline once we're open and once we have a vast variety of community programming over the course of all four seasons. And so what we think that will really do is to drive new economic opportunities for new small businesses and existing small businesses in the neighborhood and in the community. It's one of the reasons why I think a lot of members of the local community are incredibly supportive and excited about this project, because it will be a way, I think, to highlight the best of the neighborhood and the Lower East Side and to drive New Yorkers and many other people to come and hopefully invest in and spend in the neighborhood.
Can you guys imagine eventually some actual consumer-facing technology coming out of this, like some way for me to install some things in my own roof, in my house, that would feed an indoor garden?
You know, if this ever reaches the point where it becomes commercially viable or accessible, let's say, to the average residential consumer or whatever, I think it would be amazing, right? You could use it to light up interior rooms. You could use it to light up basements. You could use it to light up hospitals, jails, schools, space stations, whatever, right? You know, our hope is that the technology, which is pretty fresh, will eventually develop to that point.
A big part of this is actually making the case for natural sunlight and understanding why natural sunlight is worth it. Your earlier question, humans feel better in natural sunlight and thereby creating more of a beautiful environment. So, you know, what we're trying to say is, you know, certainly in a city where large buildings crowd out the sun on most blocks and most people don't live in apartments without a lot of natural sunlight, the importance of thinking about how we channel sunlight and bring it from one location to another is something that could have really, really, really big impact on all of our lives.
Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think back to where you were 20 years ago, 1996. Alanis Morissette was at the top of the charts. Dolly the Sheep was cloned in Scotland. And here in the U.S., then-President Bill Clinton signed the Welfare Reform Bill into law. Clinton wasn't the only one obsessed with altering welfare. Welfare reformers were everywhere, even inside the system. As part of our new documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is taking us back to Riverside, California, even a few years further, into 1993, and into the welfare office that changed how we think about cash assistance.
Which brings us to the story of a guy named Larry Townsend. He's got close-cropped white hair and one of those Army General smiles that never quite turns up at the edges. Today, Larry is 79, retired. He lives in a beach town in California where he drives around in a green Cadillac Seville with a brass frame around the license plate. And etched into the brass, it says,
"Life works if you work."
Larry loves work. Just the idea of it. It's one of the two main concepts that define his worldview. The second thing that defines Larry, as much as he loves work, he hates welfare. It's his other obsession.
I've seen so much damage to people that are on welfare. They have no hope for a better future. They aren't setting a good example for their children.
And he's got a collection of stories devoted to this belief. Anecdotes that date back decades to his early career in county government. Like the one about his visit to a welfare office where he saw two kids waiting for their mom in the lobby, playing pretend.
One of the children was playing the welfare recipient. The other one was playing the eligibility worker. Now you tell me they aren't learning how to get on welfare. That one causes tears still.
This is the kind of anecdote that gets told and retold among critics of welfare. An individual moment that may not be typical of welfare recipients in general, but for critics represents all the failings of the system. But what makes Larry's anecdotes unique? Two decades ago, he was in a position to do something about them because he became the head of a welfare department in a big suburban county east of L.A. called Riverside. The way he saw it, his role in this welfare office,
to invade and conquer. That was my attitude.
And in the late 80s, he got the perfect chance to wage his war. At the time, the government was reconsidering its approach to cash welfare for poor families. But then the question was, how? And Larry Townsend had some ideas.
I was absolutely stunned that I was given freedom to design a program, to implement a program, It was an opportunity to change the concept of welfare.
Larry's changes happened under a pilot program in California called Greater Avenues for Independence, GAIN for short. There were two basic avenues county welfare offices could experiment with. Some went the education and training route. The idea was to help poor single moms who'd often dropped out of school get more skills, maybe a GED, to fare better on the job market. Larry did not have much patience for that approach. His approach in Riverside, much simpler and cheaper.
Get people into a job immediately.
Don't worry about, are you trained enough or do you have enough education? Just get that job.
We're not going to train you for years. We're not going to send you to school for years. We're going to show you how to find a job.
You can still hear the conviction in Larry's voice almost 30 years later. Listen to that.
How to find a job.
And the point of this job-first approach wasn't to find the perfect job or even a very well-paying job.
But at least your foot is in the door, and how well you succeed from there is up to you.
With one important catch.
If you do not cooperate with us, we will take you off of welfare.
To carry out his jobs first plan, Larry restructured his welfare office to run job search classes and job clubs.
I remember being at the GAIN office and they
Sophia
said they
Elsman had just signed up for welfare in Riverside at the time. She'd grown up poor, her family had been on welfare when she was a child, and now that she and her husband had just split up, she needed some help supporting her kids while she looked for a job and got her life back together. Her intake worker said she'd need to enroll in the GAIN pilot program.
They said it's to get you out there in the workplace, which was fine with me. Because that's what I wanted to do anyways. You know, I've been working since I was 14 years old.
Sophia says there were workshops on finding jobs.
How to fill out applications, how to do interviews.
They'd get a list of leads, she says, and be told to start calling around. There was kind of a Weight Watchers vibe to it. When they landed an interview, people would cheer. But all this was just the beginning of Larry Townsend's plans for the welfare recipients of Riverside. Larry's vision was much bigger.
Infect welfare recipients with a positive attitude, with the beauty and glory of work. And so I became sort of like a preacher for work.
And a preacher needs tools to evangelize.
I have a few materials that I can show you. Booklets, posters, billboards.
Almost 30 years later, Larry still has his files.
There's some that I wanted to show you.
All the marketing ephemera his office made, full of welfare-to-work slogans.
Success stands on your backbone, not your wishbone. Action turns dreams into realities. Get into gear. Start a career.
I am the difference.
Self-sufficiency is supporting
yourself. A person
who aims at nothing has a target he can't miss.
Be proud of honest labor.
Don't wait for your ship to come in. Swim out to it.
Going through Larry's archives is like walking through a gift shop at a national landmark commemorating work. There are souvenirs of every variety designed to appeal to as many of a welfare recipient's senses as possible. Messages printed on bumper stickers, on buttons, messages you could see, you could touch. And for the ears, well, there was this.
I thought music is a very inspirational form of communication.
And so Larry made that CD that you heard a bit of before called Work Makes the Difference. He used $2,000 of taxpayer money, no authorization, to record it.
And I figured I might get fired over it.
But he didn't. This is the first track, the title track.
Will your children be the next generation? Or will you be the last? Welfare's temporary, not a way of life. Be proud of honest labor. Have dignity and pride.
The music was made to be played in welfare waiting rooms over the PA system, to be the hold music when people called up the welfare office. It would play during voicemail greetings. There are 10 songs in all, different genres to appeal to different demographics, Larry says. There's a song that features a whole rap section.
Supporting yourself is helping yourself. You've got to have some dignity and pride.
And then there's a jazzy Andrews Sisters sort of 40s thing that is very hard not to snap your fingers to.
Do-wop, do-wop, wow. It
And whether it was the songs themselves, or the buttons, the billboards, the bumper stickers, the job clubs, or just the job-first strategy altogether, somehow Larry's plan in Riverside seemed to work.
The results in Riverside were the most impressive we had ever seen in a welfare-to-work program up to that time.
This is sociologist James Riccio. He was actually hired by the government to study Riverside's Jobs First program. Turns out the families who participated in it, 5 years later, they were doing way better than the ones who stayed on the plain old welfare program where they just got checks, no job clubs or job pep talks. The Job First folks had more jobs. They were making more money. They were also doing better than the people on welfare who lived in other parts of the state and got the education-first strategy instead. And because of all of this,
Larry Townsend, the director, became a kind of star in this narrow world of welfare reform.
But this narrow world was about to widen and play a very big role on the national stage. And Larry's get-a-job-any-job approach for welfare recipients became known as
Riverside Miracle.
A miracle that paved the way for the federal welfare reform bill that was signed into law in 1996 and ended welfare as we know it. There's just one catch. Years later, after all that had happened, it turned out the Riverside Miracle wasn't such a miracle after all.
And you're going to have to listen to the rest of The Uncertain Hour to find out what happens next. But I am joined by our correspondent, Chrissy Clark, who is the host of this docu-pod, I guess we call it. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, Lizzie.
Why examine welfare reform and why now?
There is the anniversary thing. It's been 20 years since President Clinton went into the Rose Garden and signed the welfare reform bill that, quote unquote, ended welfare as we know it. And so I started thinking a lot about, you know, I cover lots of issues around poverty and what we do for those who have the least and what kind of economic mobility and opportunities they have. And welfare comes up all the time, but you realize that people talk about welfare, they have very strong opinions about welfare, but they often don't really know what welfare is anymore. Like, what is the program since we ended it as we know it?
And what are we going to hear next on the show?
So one thing we're doing is just following the money, looking at how federal welfare dollars actually get spent. And it's kind of mind-blowing. Like, some of the things that fall under this umbrella of welfare involve everything from marriage counseling classes for middle-class couples in Oklahoma to college scholarships to private schools for kids whose families make more than $200,000 a year. We're also going to be looking at the folks who kind of got left behind. There's actually this growing group of people that poverty experts call the quote-unquote disconnected. There are some people who just really have trouble finding jobs and then are not accessing welfare in any way and are living on less than $2 a day sometimes.
That's Chrissy Clark from Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty team. You can find The Uncertain Hour on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thank you, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, tell us about your will or why you don't have one. Ask us questions about wills, too. Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Simitovich is our senior producer, with help this week from Golda Arthur. Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.